Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Hello again, everybody. So Apple was found guilty of antitrust violations last week for conspiring with book publishers on ebook pricing. Follow that case? Were you thinking about that as you read your ebook in the shade this weekend? Probably not, but if you read books on a device and you care about books at all, e or otherwise, Michael Kater, founder of Publishers Marketplace and Publishers Lunch, is here to explain the latest in the fight over the ebook market, why Amazon is still king after this ruling, and whether there's actually a high cost to the low price of ebooks. And we'll also get into the Penguin Random House merger and the failure of Barnes & Noble Nook, their Nook reading device, and the departure of their CEO. Might even the mighty Barnes & Noble not survive the brick-and-mortar bookstore shakeout? Michael Kater, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks. Happy to be back with you.
So in the Apple case, they colluded in order to set up so-called agency pricing, where the publishers got to set the price and Apple would take a cut of that, as opposed to the way that Amazon does it, where they buy wholesale and the retailer, Amazon itself, sets the price. And I'm curious if you think that one is more manipulative than the other, because the average listener out there may think, oh, well, Apple and the publishers colluding to set a price, that's not a good thing. But Amazon having a near monopoly on setting the price, that's not a good thing.
I think you raise a very legitimate point. It's part of this is really trying to figure out how goods are supposed to be sold when they're digital. In truth, it never made sense logically that an ebook should be sold on a wholesale basis because it's not a physical good. There is no wholesaling involved. Nobody's shipping it to a warehouse while it sits around and waits to find a customer. It's a file that gets sold when somebody wants it. So there was always a reasonable basis for saying there should be some different way of publishers and retailers dealing with each other for selling an ebook than the way they did for well over 100 years when they were selling physical books.
And I guess it's an antitrust suit because the publishers, more than one publishing house that's supposed to be competing with each other, got together with Apple to set some kind of standard pricing mechanism. And they all wanted the ebook prices to go up. The $9.99 or whatever Amazon was charging was considered too low. But are we supposed to be sympathetic to those companies, even as we're suspicious of Amazon? You know, they say how the pricing that Amazon puts out presents an existential threat. Do you accept that, or are they just blowing smoke so they can charge more?
It's all terribly confusing to try to explain to a regular reader. When Amazon was charging $9.99 initially, it was often below cost pricing, which is sometimes considered predatory in and of itself in America. And it was selective. It was on best-selling books and on some new releases, but they very effectively sort of persuaded customers that was the top price, when in fact almost a third of their merchandise sold for more than $9.99.
Mm-hmm.
And when they were doing that, let's remember, too, that the Kindle devices cost close to $400. So they had an incentive to get people to buy expensive new devices by promising them, don't worry, once you make the investment in the device, the ebooks are going to be cheap. And we should all bear in mind that for most people who buy ebooks, in fact, they're buying the ebooks after they've bought some other kind of device that costs a lot more than the books themselves, and those device purchases don't give any money to the authors who are writing the books. So it's still going to be a while before we figure out what's the right price for which kind of ebook. And ultimately, the marketplace is going to decide that. I think publishers, for their part, are trying to ensure an ecosystem that survives so that publishers can stay in business and that authors can still both make money from their work but also have a publisher on their side if they choose to. There's also lots of self-publishing options now. So for authors who don't want to publish with a publisher or prefer the economic scenario of going straight to the marketplace, that exists for them too.
So readers, writers, publishers want to weigh in on this, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Does the battle between Apple and Amazon matter to you? Does it matter to content? Does it matter to culture? 212-433-9692. As we talk to Michael Cater from Publishers Lunch and founder of Publishers Marketplace, 212-433-9692. But on your last point, when you talk to people, they think it makes logical sense that the ebook would be cheaper than the physical book because it's a digital copy. But there's an argument that this is wrong-headed. You're paying for the content, not the form that it comes in. But do you know what percentage of the price of a book, an old, you know, fashioned physical book, is materials and shipping and bookstore rent and bookstore employees, as opposed to really paying for the intellectual property?
Well, bookstore rent and bookstore employees get counted on a different side of the line than the cost of the physical goods. You know, to physically print a book is not all that expensive. What's expensive is the investment made in giving the author money to go write the book, and all the staff that helps make that book ready for market and goes and publicizes the book and moves it throughout the chain. There's no question that there are economic savings when you take some of that physical inventory out of the chain. Most publishers are still selling a lot of their books in print, so they're maintaining both a print network as well as an ebook network. Most ebooks do cost less than the physical book. It's really a question of how much less. And as I said, I think, you know, in the end, the marketplace is going to figure that out. The other thing to keep in mind is when ebooks first came along, for many people, they were inferior. They have fewer privileges. They didn't work as well as they should have necessarily. But as more people get accustomed to e-reading, they actually see it as having greater benefits because you can decide you want to read a book, and within a minute, more or less, that book can be on your device and you can be reading. You don't have to go to the store to get it. You don't have to wait for it to be delivered to you. You can. It doesn't have any weight. It doesn't take up any room on your bookshelves. So the more people get used to electronic reading and the more they like it, for many people, they see it as superior rather than inferior. So some of it is sort of what's it worth to you versus what's it worth to someone else.
And a publishing industry survey found that ebooks now account for 20% of publishers' revenue, up from 15% last year. Do you know Amazon's market share?
Amazon's market share is approximately 60%. Market share is a little hard to determine up until this court case.
That's market share of ebooks, right? Because I should really distinguish, because Amazon's really got two things going on. They've got the ebooks because the Kindle came early, so people think about Amazon for ebooks. But then, of course, they're also selling by mail order all these hard copy books.
Correct. Yes. So their market share of the ebook market in the United States is roughly 60%. And we only really knew the precise market share until this court case, because up until then, no one had to disclose all of the data to an independent third party. In the court case, all of the major retailers did provide their data to expert witnesses who came back and actually verified for us what the approximate market shares were.
Right. So the rise of ebooks makes it harder for brick-and-mortar stores to sell you actual physical books. We see what happened to Borders. And I'm curious about your understanding of how Barnes & Noble is doing. Their CEO left after a dismal earnings report just recently, and they announced the cancellation and failure of the Nook, their e-reader. Is Barnes & Noble not long for this world?
I think people mistakenly associate some of the transitional issues that Barnes & Noble is having with this idea that they're on the verge of going out of business. They're doing what a business like that needs to do, right, which is figure out how to play in both the print market that they've always played in as well as this new digital market, which is lower dollar volume, and it hasn't fully replaced print at all, but is clearly the important future market. Part of Barnes & Noble's problem is their balance sheet is entirely dependent on selling physical books and selling ebooks, so they don't have a big fat balance sheet like Apple or Amazon where they can hide the costs of entry into this new business. And everybody understands that this is the ebook business is in the investment stage right now, not in the profit-taking stage. The good news for people who love books and who love print books and love going into bookstores to find them is that the Barnes & Noble bookstores are actually doing quite well and had a quite respectable positive earning margin for the previous year.
Uh-huh.
They lost a lot of money on Nook, although they also brought in a lot of investment for Nook from Microsoft and Pearson and before that Liberty Media. So they're trying to find their level, and they are certainly having troubles. They can't compete as a consumer electronics manufacturer on the same level of far larger corporations. They've learned that the hard way, and they're retrenching. And so the next question isn't so much can the bookstores survive, but can they hold on to a respectable ebook market share if they're not going to be making devices in the same numbers that they used to?
Interesting. One group of people who that's good news for, I think, is parents, because I think the children's sections in the Barnes & Noble stores in particular, and you know, other larger bookstores where they can set up an area for kids, is such a valuable thing to have, to go to with your kids. I certainly had that experience with my kids when they were little, and I was just in Barnes & Noble on the Upper West Side yesterday and saw how vibrant the children's section was there with parents and, you know, mostly littler kids being there in a way that kind of inculcates reading culture and how it's a fun thing to a lot of little kids. So that's, you know, something that they may or may not be monetizing very much, but I think it's good for the world that it continued to exist. One interesting detail that I read in David Carr's column in the Times today was that immediately after Borders went under, sales of ebooks fell, suggesting that a reduced opportunity to browse physical books on actual shelves resulted in less online buying. Do you buy that?
No, I don't. I like David's column, the overall point of which was that physical display space is important for everyone, including Amazon and Apple, because people still often find the books they want by going into a bookstore. Ebook sales did not fall after Borders went bankrupt. We could have a discussion about whether the rate of increase moderated and whether that was due to Borders going bankrupt, or in fact Apple also changed their rules about how you could buy ebooks on other people's platforms on their devices at about that same period in time. So I think the Borders linkage is a little mistaken. But well, I think the overall point, which is people like to find, discover, and sample books in real bookstores, both Barnes & Noble's and independent stores and all kinds of other stores that carry books, is very valid. And I think publishers understand and worry that if physical store display space goes away, that many fewer people will take the trouble or be able to discover books.
Readers, writers, publishers, 212-433 WNYC for Michael Cater from Publishers Lunch and Publishers Marketplace. Melanie in Westbury, you're on the air. Hi, Melanie.
Hi. I'm doing well. Thank you for having me on the show. I want to make a short, concise contribution, which is that I actually have sold these products, the e-readers, for a long time. And one of the things that we typically tell customers is that buying an e-book is not the same as buying a book in that you're buying the license, not the physical product. What that means is that anytime they want to, if they feel like you are, quote unquote, abusing your account, they can revoke your rights to the book. So, for example, if my boyfriend and I both have the desire to read the same book and Amazon sees that we're using it on too many devices, like, let's say, multiple cell phones or multiple e-readers, they can revoke the account entirely, rendering all of the licenses that were previously purchased invalid and non-refundable. So in my opinion, because of this risk, an ebook should cost less to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Is it even possible to abuse that sharing? I haven't had a Kindle, so I don't know. But I don't see how. I do have an iPad, and I've downloaded some books, and I don't see how I could share it with someone else. So is there a way you can actually abuse that license?
Yes. So, for example, let's say I have an Android Galaxy S4, and you have an iPhone, and your son or daughter has an iPad, and then somebody else in your family has a Kindle, and you log the same account onto all of those devices.
Mm-hmm. Because you can re-download the book?
Exactly. So all of those files are essentially being held in cloud storage.
Yes.
So any one of those devices would have access to them, which normally, if you buy a physical book and you keep it in your, let's say, the study in your house or, you know, in your den or wherever, anyone in your family would have access to that book. That's what comes along. That's a privilege that comes along with having a physical book in your house. Whereas if you're buying the e-file, what Amazon or any of these companies really are saying is, no, this license is for you and you only. Mm-hmm. You can share it, but only for a limited amount of days. And there's a procedure that you go through for that. Now, what that procedure is in general, I'm not sure offhand for every single book, e-book.
Right, but it's something along those lines. Melanie,
well,
thank you.
Just to be clear, although it is true that an e-book carries a limited license, generally speaking, ebooks let you put that file onto up to 5 devices. And you can, in fact, read simultaneously on the allowed number of devices, which we could argue you can't do with a print book. You can't have 5 people reading a print book simultaneously. The number of licenses, the number of devices is limited. It is 5. I'm not aware of anyone having their accounts revoked because they tried to put it on more devices than were allowed.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine it would make news if they did. But it is true. It comes with a limited set of privileges.
RJ in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello, RJ.
Hi. I work freelance in the editorial production department for a number of book publishers. And I'm wondering if some of the unseen costs, aside from authors' royalties, that don't go away with ebook publishing were included in or considered in the court case. Books still have to be copy edited, proofread, production checked. And I've also heard a lot of complaints about typographical errors in ebooks. A friend actually got a book recalled and reissued because there were so many errors in it.
That's interesting. So, Michael, I guess you addressed her first question earlier, which is that basically the cost of the publishers go overwhelmingly to content, to the writers, right? And the staff that makes the whole thing happen.
Well, the costs are distributed through the process. Some of it goes to the writers, some of it goes to the editors and the designers and the freelancers who help make the book ready for market. Some of it goes to cover the cost of operating the company and the salespeople and the distribution people who spread the book throughout the chain. To be clear, however, the court case wasn't really about what an ebook ought to cost. The central facet of the case was the allegation that Apple and the publishers colluded to change prices altogether at the same point in time. The judge and the Department of Justice said that what each company did, had they done it fully independently of each other and or not at the same time as each other, was completely legal. So the case wasn't about what an ebook should cost, but simply focused on the idea of whether there was collusion in changing pricing models.
Right, because if they negotiated deals one by one, it wouldn't have worked to raise the industry-wide average price, I guess, as they were trying to do. Just real quick, a couple of things before we run out of time. Back to the Nook. It wasn't a terrible device, right? I've never used one, but it received critical praise. Why did Barnes & Noble's Nook fail in that marketplace?
It's the Nook tablets that they ran into trouble into. The Nook black and white, or rather e-ink readers, did well. Nook actually had sort of what they called color tablets before tablets and iPads became popular. It was really last Christmas season when they kind of tried to go head-to-head with iPad, Kindle Fire, all the other full-color tablets mm-hmm. with full computing capabilities right. from other retailers that they overextended themselves. The devices were very well reviewed, but at the end of the day, that's become a mass-market product, and people want to go to a big consumer electronics giant for their tablet rather than a company like Barnes & Noble. So they overproduce.
And finally, the big 6 publishers became the big 5 with the Penguin Random House merger. Does the merger signal anything to you? Does it mean something for the future of content?
You know, you can look at the merger a lot of different ways. It creates the largest trade publishing company in the world and the largest that the business has ever seen. So some people see it as a sign that there will be a publisher of heft that can sort of hold its ground in a world in which the retailers and the consumer electronics device makers are trying to dictate the terms. Other people fear that it's sort of too big to prosper and that authors will get lost inside. But fortunately, there are lots and lots of smaller companies as well. I think it's a sign that there's going to be companies of great scale trying to hold their own as this business continues to change.
And don't you think it should have been called Random Penguin House instead of Penguin Random House? That, wouldn't that be a cooler name, Random Penguin House?
That is certainly the sentimental favorite among many.
Michael Kater, founder of Publishers Marketplace and Publishers Lunch. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, a brief history of Internet spam. And we'll take calls on what clever spam you have actually fallen for. Stay with us.